Hey fam, welcome back to the Mostable Podcast, the show for curious, culturally complex people who are finding their voice in the in-between. Now, today's episode is a little different because I have something important to share with you. It's back to school season, and while most people are shopping for school supplies and prepping lunchboxes, many of us, especially those parenting in immigrant or multicultural homes, are carrying invisible loads. Loads like advocating for kids who don't quite fit the mold, navigating behavioral concerns, or trying to make sense of school systems that were never designed with our families in mind. That's why the Mostable Podcast presents More Than a Backpack. It's a live discussion panel, and trust me, is one you won't want to miss. The panel was born out of my own journey after a rough start to public kindergarten with my daughter, with what followed was a series of moments that left me feeling unseen, frustrated, and searching for community. So in true Mostable fashion, we turned that pain into purpose. We're joined by a powerful lineup of fellow parents and a developmental behavioral pediatrician. We plan to unpack the emotional toll of parenting through the school year. If you ever left a parent-teacher meeting with more questions than answers, or just needed someone to say, hey, you're not crazy, you're not alone, this conversation is for you. This panel will hold on Saturday, 19th of July, on all our streaming platforms. And of course, you can watch the replay. If this sounds like something your village needs to hear, go ahead and share. Let's make sure every parent carrying more than a backpack knows we see them. Now enjoy the show. Was it Maya Angelou who said, you only are free when you realize you belong no place, belong every place, no place at all. The prize is high, the reward is great. So welcome back, everyone, to the Mostable Podcast, where we explore the rich, layered realities of diasporan life, identity, and the art of becoming.
Yeah.
In this episode, I'm so honored to bring back to the podcast someone whose life and work embodies, you know, these themes deeply. Mm-hmm. She's a writer. In no particular order, she's a writer, organizational psychologist, a pharmacist, a learning and development leader, and most tenderly, a mother. Her new book, The Belonging Paradox, captures a question many of us carry quietly. Where do we truly belong when home is both here and there? As a Nigerian immigrant raising children in the U.S., she brings more than theory. She has lived experience, even wisdom, soul, and strategy. From navigating snack shaming incidents at school to writing affirmations on bathroom mirrors, her journey of advocacy is both fierce and tender. So if you ever felt the weight of parenting in a culture that isn't your own, today's episode is for you. During this time, we'll explore how to advocate for your children in unfamiliar systems, the meaning of belonging when you live in both worlds, in between worlds, The quiet leadership of immigrant parenting, and how reframing neurodivergence can be an act of radical love. So stay with us. This episode is going to be rich with so many things. But please, everyone, join me in welcoming Dr. Otito Iwochukwu, my personal person, to the
podcast. Thank you so much, Mo. Thank you. I'm so glad to be back. Every time you bring me on, I'm honored. I feel like, you know, because I've almost like walked alongside you on this journey, you know, 7-8 years.
Right, right.
And you're just chipping away at it. It's
right.
Joy to behold.
Is just never enough. Like, mm-hmm. we're always looking for more stuff. Like, how do you get time to do all this work? You say, yeah, like I was saying. All right. Let's, you've been on the podcast many times, so we're just going to skip a lot of the intro, but quickly for our listeners who are just like, I don't want to go listen from the beginning, which we're going to tag all of the episodes that Dr. Uchuka has been, just briefly, just a little bit of sizzle about who you are and where you're from, especially where you're from.
Okay, so as Dr. Mo said, my name is Otito Iwochukwu. I'm a mom, pharmacist, organizational psychologist, and author. I was going to say recently author, but no, I've been writing for quite a while.
Because I'm going to make that correction for you.
I've been writing for quite a while. And like you said, you know, I'm an immigrant woman. I don't think that can ever go away. Straddling both worlds, both cultures, call myself multicultural, right? Because Nigeria itself is made up of many cultures, right? Mm. People were not hegemony, neither are we like, you know, a homogeneous society. So I take pride in that, right? That just being from that country exposes you to many different cultures and many different languages that help you, you know, as you make your way in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not even forced diversity. Like, we've been diverse from day one. Like, you walk down your street where you grew up, you see it everywhere. It doesn't feel very forced.
And you're learning them, right? In order to communicate with, you know, your friends. So, yeah.
That's your key to survival. Yeah. Now, you wear many hats, right? So we listed your bio: writer, psychologist, pharmacist, mom. Which of these roles, you know, most surprised you? And how do you think motherhood has redefined your understanding of identity and success?
I think it's motherhood, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like the others, you're kind of trained for them.
Yeah.
Somehow or the other. So you feel like, okay, I got a bit of competence here. But with motherhood, I remember telling my husband one time, I said, no one was given the parenting manual. You know, we are just, you just have to kind of figure it out as you go along, obviously with a lot of prayer, but no one got the manual, you know, not because he was trying to say, well, you carried the child. I said, yeah, but I did not get the manual.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one where, you know, every day it's a new thing, full of a lot of joys, you know. So it's not like someone is complaining in that sense, but you just know from the beginning that this is a job that did not come with a job description.
Yeah. And whereas most jobs where you can learn as you learn as you go, even with motherhood, it just changes every season. And as a child is changing, you have to adapt to. And then you realize that the culture you grew up in and the culture you're raising kids in are totally different. So it's a constant learning and relearning, and also learning from your kids if you're very smart to know that you have to learn from them and how to parent them better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think your response really was that Nigerian proverb, the one who wears many beads must learn how to dance differently.
Yes.
All right. I know you have many stories to share about it, but was there a specific moment in your parenting journey that made you pause and think, I need to approach this differently because I'm parenting in a new culture?
Yeah, I think it was when, you know, my children were young, and anybody who has raised children in America knows you're literally doing a lot of things yourself. I don't want to say everything, but a lot, right, in that sense. And so, you know, you kind of go to work, go to one end of town, pick up another child, go to another end of town, pick up another child, and you're trying to do all of these things and do the after school activities, you know, all of that. So I was always quite frazzled, I have to say. And it was the children who told me. They were like, Mom, you're always, I mean, they didn't say the word mad, but they were always like, you're quite impatient, you know. And obviously patience is something I've always struggled with. And so having them just almost like triple magnified it. But they told me, they were like, you're not, I mean, again, they didn't really say you're not a nice person to be around, but it was
just like,
why are you always frazzled? Like, everything is, you know, to the 10th degree with you. And I was like, wow, okay. You know, and you know, being children, they'll tell you what's on their minds, right?
Like that. But that's also a credit to you and your husband's parenting. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Because they mirror that confidence you've given them. Yeah. Like, hey, you call it out when it, even if you have to call me up as your parent, if I'm not doing something right.
Yeah.
I'm open to that challenge, even though it might be the wrong
way. I have to
say
that that's true. And sometimes I kind of, I don't question it because I think that it's a good way to go about in life. But I kind of have to swallow it and just be like, oh my God, you're the one that started this journey, right? So you have to just take what you're given in that sense. I have to say, you can imagine that it's gotten them in trouble in school and, you know, good trouble in that sense. Mm-hmm. But I remember when my first son was in third grade and I was the school mom. And so, you know, he had had like perfect grades, perfect everything all through. And then he changed teachers, right? It's always a person. And within 3 weeks, he brought like 2 behavior reports home. And I'm like, this is not the child that I have. So I then, you know, I said, what is going on, right? You're just only sending me like negative reports about this child. What are the positives? And then she, you know, she turned, she apologized and all that. But then when I went into the school for the end of year party, and I remember her telling them to do something ridiculous. It was something ridiculous. But again, I always say to myself, I don't know that I could handle 25 children, right? I have that empathy for them, you understand? Because of reduced resources, they're alone, they don't really have teacher's aides anymore. So it's a lot to corral 25, you know, kids.
Little kids, yeah, with yes. different personalities and different backgrounds.
I remember what she was asking them to do did not make any sense. And guess who was the person who said, why are you asking us to this?
It was the boy in the little emperor, the emperor and the...
And I remember thinking, this is why you get in trouble. Like, I remember thinking, I didn't say anything. I just was like, you know, she literally said, because I said so. And I'm like,
oh, no. yeah thanks for sharing that. That's that's comforting. Now there's a statistics I read somewhere that nearly one out of four children in the U.S. has at least one immigrant parent.
Yep.
And in our case it's like two parents for both of us.
Yeah
many of these parents, and they feel deeply isolated. What would you say has been the most challenging about raising kids from, you know, the way we were raising them in a different culture that we were grown, that we were raised in? And what moments would you say have brought you unexpected joy?
Oh my God. Do you want me to start? I think you mentioned the word culture, right? Mm-hmm. I think just not understanding the culture that people come from is a big, what's the word, deterrent, right? Yeah. Or hindrance to just, you know, learning and helping make the families feel like they belong in the school system. And I use the word belonging very, very crucially.
Yeah.
Because, you know, anybody who has heard my story probably knows my younger son has ADHD. And one of the signs of ADHD is anxiety, right? Like, I'm just like, if you read the most basic thing about this, you would know that these children get anxious when they're placed in, you know, learning environment that are very stimulating, right? And so you come back and you're like, oh, this child is unduly anxious. And I'm like, what part of the fact that he has ADHD are you not understanding? You know, and it's like, oh, maybe it's from home, you know, because we heard that you guys are too strict. Like,
you heard from who?
You know, and that's the thing, like sometimes you feel like you're the one that gave away yourself, because I remember at a meeting I was just telling them that my children don't do summer slump, they walk through the summer. And I remember them saying, isn't that a lot? And I said, well, if they come back from summer break and they're slacking, guess who is going to still be called, right? So I said, I'm not that parent. They will work through the summer. Before they go play, they get 2 hours of, you know, instruction activity. That statement did not leave my record. Let me put it that way. And I kept thinking, I'm an educator for heaven's sake. Like, what part of me insisting that my children continue learning through the summer is a negative thing, right? But you see, that's what I mean. And I'm thinking, you all should come to Nigeria and see something.
That's how they do. You will get left behind. We go, as we are leaving school, you're going for lessons. Holiday, you're learning through it.
Say, we're not even talking summer, we're talking all.
What is summer? What's summer break? Where you're just doing camps? What's summer break? That's for the train. Like, you don't do that. You're learning, you have lesson teachers.
They'll come to the house morning, afternoon, night, you know? So that was it. And so
I have... We're even lucky now. We have virtual... You will not come to listen with your body.
So I have to tell you, I had to ask for a meeting with the principal. The principal changed, and this new principal, I said, I must have a meeting with you. And one of the things that I'm going to request, if you all do not pay attention, is I'm going to go to the school superintendent. Of these people have to have cultural competency training, because it's ridiculous, right? If a child comes to you and says, oh, you know, my mom punished me, you're not asking what kind of punishment. You just hear the word punishment and you just say, oh, you know, take it to arms. What if the punishment is just taking away a device for the afternoon, right? Is that a cruel and unusual punishment? I don't think so. And I know you don't think so as well, you know. So I said, you have to always verify from the parents. I know things happen, you know, all kinds of things with, you know what I mean? Things where children get maltreated and all, but there should be precedence. Have you ever seen a child come to
school hungry? Yeah.
I own their clothes. That's how crazy it is that you're thinking, here I am, spending time in the morning making the child look good, and you think I'll turn around and then, you know, but again, it's them not understanding the culture that you're coming from. So
yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And usually I would keep this part to the very end, but I feel like it's a good segue because a lot of what we'll be unpacking, especially in providing support to parents in diaspora, will come from it. So let's talk about your new book.
Okay.
The Belonging Paradox.
Yeah.
It's available on Amazon, guys. And so don't say you're not told. And she's also having a book tour currently where you can go grab a copy and get a signed copy.
First
of all, Belonging Paradox. Even the title self, you know. they say that the most personal stories are often the most universal, right? So what moment sparked the idea for this book and how did your life shape the writing?
Oh my goodness, again. So many moments, so many pivotal moments. I mean, I've talked about this school system now. That was a big one. That was a big one for our family because, you know, if your child has an accommodation plan, right, that's already one thing.
Yeah.
Every time you have to keep going, like they have, depending on who is involved, I have to come back to this and say, depending on who is involved, which is why it can always come like, you know, all like you're blindsided or like it's coming from left field. Because I remember when we went into the school system, I went to the school psychologist myself. She did not call me. And that, you know, that thing really strikes me to say, what if I hadn't come to you, right? So it's almost like you use the family's vulnerability against us, sort of, to say, hey, these are my two sons, this is what I know about them as their mother, you know, this is the one I'm concerned about, this one not so much, you know, kind of went through all of that. And she took notes. She was like, yeah. This is the same woman who every second she's calling me. She literally told me that she's been a psychologist for 46 years, and so she knows when children can make it and when they cannot make it. And I said, what?
Wow. Like, oh my goodness.
I remember saying to her, like, you have a very fixed mindset. Oh, she got so upset. She was like, I teach this stuff, Carol Dweck's work. I said, but
right,
your words just let me know that your mindset is very fixed concerning children. She eventually left the school system and a new one came who is younger, more contemporary. You can imagine that that one was kind of a little bit more easier to work with, you know. So, well, I'm saying from that school system, I cannot tell you the number of times when I was on the verge of pulling them out and just saying, let's maybe try homeschooling. Let's, you know, all of the things that they say women
kind of take the
job, try homeschooling, take to a different school, all of that, you know. But sometimes I'm like, if I did that, though, then there's no opportunity for both of us to kind of, you know, learn. And besides, you know, we're paying our taxes and all that. So it was that back and forth. But there were times when I was just like, we don't belong here. This child doesn't belong here.
Yeah.
Right. In that sense. And so what should we do? That shifted in the last year, as you might see from the book. But that was that one. And then secondly was when, you know, I said my children, they talk to me all the time. And so the older one was like, Mom, you know, sometimes I feel like you spend all this time with this one. I don't have the, you know, as much time and all that. And so, you know, that just got me thinking because I remember growing up too, I used to feel like, oh, Mom played favorites and all that and all that. And, you know, because I'm the youngest child, most people felt like I was a favorite. I'm like, far from it, you know? So it's kind of, you have those kinds of thoughts to say, I don't want what happened growing up to me and all this thinking for that to happen with my children. So just got me thinking about, you know, belonging in family, how that tracks and how sometimes the things we say we wouldn't do, we find ourselves doing it. And how do you then backtrack? How do you, you know, reassess, right? And become aware of what is going on with you so you don't continue a family trend, right? Or a familial trend. So
that was beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. Especially, I can imagine the struggles that came with, because as you know from our hallowed space, shout out to our Black Ivory community, which has been such a healing space for me in my journey. Learning from you and how you're so always so giving of yourself and your experiences to normalize that, what, for example, things I'm going through, is like, I've been there, and I know that it hurts. You share those stories. It comes from your heart of the struggles, but also knowing that in sharing those stories, that can help other people.
Yes.
And it's one thing I try to always replicate on this podcast. Yeah. So thanks for being a role model in that.
Yeah.
So now for your book, Belonging Paradox, right?
Yeah.
It's two in one question, and I always hate to ask those double barrel questions, but you had it coming. You named the book Belonging Paradox. what does belonging mean to you today, especially as a mom? And then the title, what is a paradox and how did you come to discover it in your own life?
So to me, I felt like this paradox was almost like, you know, two two truths and a lie, right? Living in the middle of that. And for me, it was like, you have these places where people say everyone belongs, right? Like, I'm talking about school, where if the school is in the town, ideally everybody who attends, who lives in that town, should belong in the school system, right? The school system is supposed to be a public school system for all children,
right?
But then you find that because of one thing or the other, because of children not fitting a normative space, right, or ideal, then they experience this like non-belonging, literally, right? And it's almost like it's baked into the system. That the way these things are perpetuated, I don't even think people think about it. It's just like, the child is a problem, I don't want to have to deal with them, right? And because of that, I don't want to have to deal with them. That reflects back to the parents, reflects back to the child, reflects back to the parents. So it's that, you know, back and forth. Again, let's leave school aside. You go to work, right? You have all your credentials, all your degrees, everything you're doing, and you're like, I was hired to do my work. But then over time, you find someone new comes in or something, or the, you know, environment changes, and you find yourself on the outside, almost like looking in, and you're like, but, you know, I am supposed to belong here based on the criteria, right, for entry, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Bannon, I pay my taxes.
Again, let's look at the national level, right? Now, I'm not talking undocumented immigration, please. So we're talking of us who came in the right way. We have cleared the barriers for entry, right? You said there was a barrier or some requirements. We've cleared that. We're supposed to belong, you know, but then you find people, when you talk about national systems, telling you go back to where you're from, things like that. That's trying to kind of rouse you, you know, rouse your sense of non-belonging. And I tell people, as long as you've cleared that barrier, right? If you choose to stay in this country, belonging is yours. So those are the kinds of things that I mean, the paradoxes. Like, you come in and you think, I've cleared the barrier. And then you see somebody say, take your nappy headed home, go to Africa, right? So that's the paradox. Like, if places where you're meant to belong, you find all these pockets of non-belonging. That's one. Then the second part of the paradox is this idea that we feel like belonging is always found in community. And I say, not really, right? You can be belong within and without.
Yeah,
so you have to find belonging within yourself, even before you can get more comfortable, right, in community.
Because you attract that, right, in a way. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. So, yeah.
Okay. So regarding this book, back to this book again, what's one myth about belonging you want to dismantle with this book? Because I think you've talked about that belonging within first and out. What are there additional myths you'd like to?
Yes, and that additional myth, it still ties to the paradox, is that people have to give you belonging, right? Belonging is something that people give to you. And I say, no, just because you're human, just because you're here, you already belong, right? Even for people who sometimes feel like, you know, let's say look at family systems. I say to people, as adults, we belong because we're needed to raise our children, for those of us that have children. As children, you're just being there, right? You're needed as a function of that family system. So by definition of that, you should belong, right, in that sense. So that myth of that belonging has to be almost like given to you by somebody else, I say no, right, that it's not true. Because if we understood that, we will not tolerate a lot of, you know, the things that people kind of try to throw our way just because they feel like we don't belong. They feel like we don't belong, right?
That's rich. Thanks for that. I think another question I want to ask about this book is, what was the hardest chapter for you to write, right? And which one still moves you deeply?
Yeah, it was the work chapter, I have to say.
You know, what? I knew you're gonna say. I just had this when you're gonna say that.
Yeah, work chapter was really hard for me because it was, you know, I mean, when you talk about personal, right? It was personal, and we talk about this generational thing. I remember growing up, right? My father just was very sidelined at work, I have to say. Again, you know, while we talk about Nigeria, there were also the downsides, right? Or the non-glamorous sides of a little bit of what people call tribalism, right? In that sense. And so, you know, having lived through the Biafran war for him, went through all his trauma, I guess he now comes and puts his trust in the system to say, okay, you've said if we'll all come, we'll get back what we lost during the war and we'll continue to move forward. And so that didn't happen. So watching him kind of, you know, he did it. He kind of went through and retired, but he could have been so much more ahead, right, in that sense. And so when I started having some of these issues at work, I think it was that memory that also helped me to say affliction will not arise.
Second time.
Yeah, second time. So for me, it was, you know, I guess my own, what's that, skin in the game was a bit personal, right? In that sense. But obviously, you can't tell people that. You're just like, okay, let's see where this would go. But I don't want to be known as the woman who ran away, right, from this issue. All because I kind of really felt like this would come back to bite me, right, in that sense. You know, but again, it could also be a pyrrhic victory, right? You get what you want, but at a cost. At a cost. And so,
I imagine that for you, when you said work, I because, you know, the context and all that. And because it's also still... it's still a current reality for you and having to navigate through that.
Yeah.
But, so, and we're not going to give so much away. You guys need to go read the book.
Yes, have to go get the book.
Yes, yeah, we're not going to give so much away. But let me just say, it's triumphant and...
Yeah.
I feel like there's nothing as good as just advocating for yourself.
Yes.
You can learn those tools and they are practical tools because the game is still the same. The players might be different. Yes. Honey, the game is still
exactly.
the same.
Exactly. You have to know, right?
The game is
the
same.
If you want to play the game, you have to know how to play it. Otherwise, you will be thoroughly whooped.
You're crying. Okay, let's segue into advocacy. This is, we've talked about so many parts of it.
Hmm.
What do you wish more African or immigrant parents knew about advocating for their children in American schools? In a very tender moment here, I don't think by the time this episode airs, I don't think we'll have done the panel.
Yeah.
So, and Otito knows this. Our daughter was in school, private daycare for the first 4 years of her life. We decided to move her to kindergarten at year 5. And prior to that, our experience with the private daycare was really good. I mean, we did everything. I mean, if you think about as good as you can get that whole concept of a village raising your child, I give credit to the proprietor of that school. They were very good. And, you know, we never really had, you know, big issues apart from what you expect from like 3-4 year olds trying to navigate space and boundaries and playing together. Now, tell me why the second day, as a matter of fact, the day hadn't even ended. The second day of our child entering public school, we get an email from the teacher telling us, oh, hi, my name is blah, blah. I knew who she was. Just want to let you know that your daughter isn't focusing in class. She's, as a Nigerian mom, getting that message. And I love how you talked about that in the book. Again, I'm not going to give so much away. The shame that oozed from that email. It was a very short email. It felt very strongly worded, almost like she was sending me back to your child doesn't, she's not cooperating, she doesn't have home training. And I'm like, but I also had to remind myself, this is a fact. Thank you for helping me, by the way. Like, this teacher, you know, that line was, this person is probably new to at their job and inexperienced, because how do you send the mom an email second day of kindergarten? And this kids, this is their first time in a overstimulating environment. So my question for you would be this, which, because we're going to use my daughter's example as a way to, what do you wish more African or even immigrant parents knew about advocating for their children in American school, especially when unfamiliar with the rules of being afraid of being labeled difficult or not having, giving their kids, you know, proper home training?
So I have to say it's using, like you said, your voice, right? Using your voice, but using it in a very measured, and I would say, I don't want to use the word diplomatic, but I would explain what I mean by diplomatic. You know how they say that diplomacy is telling someone to go to hell.
Yeah, and then having them take a ride or something like that.
It's almost, you know, so it's that kind of mindset. Again, I don't want to use that word because it's not as though you're going in looking for trouble, but it's what is the outcome I'm looking for and what is the best measured way that I can get to this outcome. And many times, unfortunately, it's going to involve a lot of words being pass back and forth. And so, you know, in the book, I talk about some of the ways that you can access those measures. But the thing is just to remember, right, to context. Mm. Let me use the word context. And what was the context for us? The child is five. You know, this thing you're saying, I was able to talk to you because I said, this happened to my own child. They literally called me and said, this child behaves like someone who went to Montessori school. And I said, what does that mean? So basically, you're literally almost like...
showing your gaps. Wild and untamed.
Untamed.
So I'm just saying, this child behaves like someone that went there from Africa.
Okay. And I was like, what does that mean? You know, I said, is that a bad thing? Obviously, I knew what the woman was saying. I said, is that a negative thing? She said, no, you know, it's just because in those systems, they don't have a lot of structure. They let the child lead and this and that. So already I was like, oh, we're going to be in for an interesting season, right?
No, no. Makes sense.
But I remember saying, I need evidence, right? I need evidence of what you're saying. If you're saying the child is not sitting still, how many minutes, right? Those kinds of things. I need some kind of hard evidence. What is your definition of not sitting
still?
What's your definition of, you know, bothering you? What does that mean? Let me get more context. So always ask for context. Mm. And that's why I'm saying don't rush to kind of just go make trouble. Because the problem is not, the issue is not trying to make trouble. You understand? You want your child to have a good experience. Because I always say, both you and the teachers want the same thing for the child. Ideally, you want the same thing for the child. A child who is, you know, on track, learning and all that. So this thing is a question of conflict, right? Conflict means differences in how you see things. And so, you know, it's the perspective of saying, this, what you're telling me, I don't see it at home. I want to work with you. Let's see how this goes.
Right?
You know, so it's that sense of you're not helpless, using your voice and just helping them see, okay. Because what happens many times is that we take in what they've told us and then either do nothing about it or feel so badly about it.
Yep.
Where's the middle ground? The middle ground should be, how can I ensure that the child is meeting the outcomes that I put them in this school for, and that the whole school, the system is helping me do that, right?
Yeah.
As best as they can. Yeah. And I tell people, I don't know if I should say that on this podcast.
Say it. Now you have to say it.
You can change teachers. You don't have to stay the same.
You might not be famous for it, but you can have your grounds for that.
They will tell you, you probably hear a lot of things, but you can ask for that, and you obviously have to document and all that, but you don't have to subject your child to a negative learning environment. Once you've have enough evidence that this teacher does not have the child's maybe best interest at heart, you can ask that the child be moved to another classroom.
So to my moms, maybe come August, you might be getting some emails or comments about your kids. First of all, take a deep breath. What you will not do is to look at that 5-year-old child and say, "Kilo Shane school, what are you doing in school? Don't kill me in the school." They're still five, okay? I remember that sometimes people in authority, for example, the teachers, the proprietors, the headmistress, or whatever their names are, they might have this longevity of time that we spend with that kids. Doesn't necessarily mean they always know what's right. And I say that very respectfully, of course. The bias that oozes sometimes from their language, you have to even help them almost regurgitate your words to them and be like, can you hear what you're saying? And can you see how it's so layered, so deep, so obvious that there's bias that you don't even know? And we've had moments like that with my school. Let me just say they won't forget us in a hurry. Mm-hmm. But we've done things in a very respectful way. And I've been so proud.
Yeah.
Of just the advocacy I've had to do for my child. It wasn't always comfortable. And I know people, I sound like I'm always, you know, ready to fight. No. Mm-hmm. When it came to my child, there was a crippling fear, and it was so many things. It felt too personal.
Mm-hmm.
It felt too personal. But I thank God for people like Otito and my sister Tope, who have really helped me stay grounded. Like, nope, we're going to help them help you. Here's how.
Yep.
So Now, my next question for you is, you know, how do we, in a system that can feel overwhelming, say as a mom, and moms like us, we're the ones that are very, what's the word, on top of things, is why these things really feel like a personal one.
Yeah.
What are some practical steps or questions? Because you've shared this a lot in our group. Parents should bring to those school meetings, especially when dealing with evaluations or concerns about their children's needs.
So, again, practical steps. You have to kind of say, give me context about the situation, right? What is the issue? You can ask, what is your concern, right? Because I think many times when those complaints come out, there's no concern. And that's the issue, right? There's no concern, because the concern should be that, okay, I need this child, you know, learning and improving and all that. Like, you don't have any constructive concern for the child. All you have is criticism, right? In that sense. And so you have to always ask, what is the concern? What is the concern here? Let me know, right? And hear from them and then say, okay, what can we do about it, right? You always want to bring in that concept of we're working together, we're in this together, right? You should not say, what should we, as the parents alone? It's like both me and the teachers, how can we help this child, right? We're here to help the child. So that's very critical, because sometimes you find that, again, depending on the teacher, right? Depending on the teacher, depending on the person behind the desk, some of them are so locked in, right, into that negativity that you have to almost, like, you know, pull them out of it. I don't have this in the book, but I remember when, you know, again, my son was in kindergarten and, you know, this, all of these concerns, and I said, okay, let's meet. Let's go to the school, meet with the psychologist and meet everyone. And I remember the whole child study team came. They didn't even tell me they were going to come. So it was a bit of a blindsiding, but I said, I got this. So, you know, so then, and that's the thing, you will find allies in the most surprising places. Which is why you have to be very calm, right? I always tell people, calmness will help you more than, you know, whatever. Not to say that there's not a time for that, but calmness always helps you. Why? Again, this is a podcast for people in diaspora and immigrants people, because you are beating a stereotype. They're expecting you to come in there, probably bringing down the walls, right? And you do not want to be that person, at least depending on the situation. So you're going to go very calmly as best as you can, and prayer is helpful, right? Or necessary in some cases. So then she said, oh, you know, it's not paying attention, this, that, that. And I remember one of the women on the team said, perhaps it could be bored, right? She just said that. And she was like, well, I don't know, you know, this, that. So she said, okay, so is his focus, is his lack of focus impeding his learning? She said, well, you know, not really, but he hasn't done as well as you'd have expected. So the woman said, oh, okay, what were the scores, right? So they have beginning of year, BOY, MOY, middle, and then N. They had done beginning and middle. And she said, he came into kindergarten, so hear me, with 93%. 93% out of 100. That was what he scored at the beginning of year test. And the woman was like, huh, that's really good though, you know? So she said, what did he score middle of year? She said 95%. And so that one said, okay, well, he's meeting all his, you know, learning milestones and everything, so what's the issue? Then she said, well, he came in reading and, you know, knowing all his alphabets, so he's not letting me focus on the ones who cannot write their names and read their names. And I said, oh, so he's having to pay now. So this is a what did you call it, a brightness tax. He's having to pay for knowing the stuff, right? In that sense. That's when she actually said, I said, so you're saying he spent 6 months with you and he only moved up 2 percentage points.
So what do you really need?
So you see what I mean by data? Like, I just sat there and I said,
context,
he only moved up 2 percentage points. Then she started talking, you know, obviously the situation. I'm telling you, the flip was like a switch. No, it wasn't that. And that's when all this came out of saying how she then has to focus on other kids. So the ones who really know it, she kind of just let them work independently. And I said, so he's paying for this. You know, I just kind of had to help her almost like review the whole situation, right? And then it was the woman, I think the occupational therapist, I can't remember, but she now started giving things to do to this teacher. I was like, okay, good. This is why you say someone is fighting your battle for you. But I just imagine what would have happened if I had gone in with a different mindset. But I just wanted, and I always say this, context is king, right? You must give me context, and then I'll give you context as well, and we'll see how we can.
Okay, see, we can both connect. But that also comes from knowing your child.
Yes.
You have to know your child.
I know my child more than me.
Yeah.
Like, he spends a lot of time with me, right? I've been with him. I know what he can do. Because even when she said, oh, well, she kept trying to argue. She said, well, his comprehension, even though he's doing well on math, and his comprehension is this. And I said, okay, explain to me what you mean by comprehension. She said, when you read the story and ask him to read back, he doesn't say anything. I said, is that a question of comprehension or just like behavioral tendencies? She said, oh, well, but that according to the, learning standards, right? That's that idea, the common core, the standards and all that. I said, this child, his comprehension is at a very high degree. I said, do you know how I know? All of them were looking at me. I said, you take this book that you're saying you have read to him and he has not responded, and change one sentence in the book.
It will bring him out.
He's going to tell you exactly where that thing was and how that was not the right sentence and how that was not what that character said.
Yeah.
I said, if that is not comprehension, then I don't know what is, you know? So these are my concerns. That we stick to this almost like rigid learning things. And I said, obviously, you will not have the time to be doing this kind of experiments I do at home, granted. But you cannot tell me that my child does not comprehend when he's reading at a fourth grade level. This was what they said in kindergarten. So what part of it? Basically, you're saying he's just reading and not comprehending what he's saying. I don't know about that, you know? So, I mean, that was, to me, the pivotal meeting in that school that let them know, okay, this woman is not playing, right, in that sense, you know? But I think what really kind of, what, like you said, when you said, is those of us who are into this.
That, yeah.
Thinking, it doesn't have to be that way, though. You understand? A person who may be working two jobs, doing all these things, needs to have the room to have their child learn in the school.
Right.
It doesn't have to be this way where you have to have a certain level of education, you have to have a certain level of this in order to, you know, for your child to get heard or listened to. I think that's what bothers me so much. And that's why I feel like every opportunity I get, I'm teaching people the things to do, the things to say, you know, how to go about it, what to do. I cannot tell you on the streets, my neighbors, so many times they'll come asking me questions. I'm like, this is what I did, you know? And it's like, what? You sent that email, you did that, you did this. And I said, I don't even try to say, oh, whatever. I just said, yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, it's within your power to do too. You are able to do this thing. You can ask for X. You can ask for Y. The most they can do is
say no. But you asked,
But you've
they have to also give you a reason, because you can always go above to the school district to say, hey, I'm waiting for this. So they can't just deny it without grounds. Or even if they do, again, you can always go above them and ask for, your taxes. Remember, you're paying for those taxes. Oh, there's so many questions I have for you, but we need to hurry up. Okay, hold on. All right. So you've given us practical tips. And I think one thing to add to that is that by the time you are done with the school, make sure you send a follow-up email.
Yep.
Make sure and read that book. Read her book. There's a chapter on there.
Yes.
Literally. Literally outlines everything for you, okay?
Yeah.
And so parenting. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So make sure
it boils down to trying to resolve that conflict. And conflict is not always negative. It's just two people seeing things in differently. So it's hard to come to a middle ground as best as you can.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps we'll even learn a little bit about your child, because you know your child, but then you don't know a lot about your child in other spaces.
Yes.
You know, so we found out, for example, Ari wasn't eating lunch. And that's because of just the overstimulation. And her teacher started saying, oh, after lunch, she doesn't focus more. Again, context. They realized, okay, I pack lunch for her, she's not eating. Mm-hmm. You guys keep saying she's not focusing. Can't you just see the correlation that after lunch, if she's not eating because there's so much noise? And in talking to Ari, we realized that the countdown they were using, you have 5 minutes, you have 10 minutes.
was giving her anxiety. Yeah.
Anxiety. And my daughter would run and lock herself up in the bathroom. I'm like, that's not my daughter. I had to demand for CCTV. I couldn't watch the CCTV because of, you know, other kids. But I asked them to watch it and also look at what's going on. They let me know that my daughter was locking herself up in the bathroom. That is not Ari's experience. We had to go back to her former teacher, that private school I told you about, said, no, that's not Ari. Again, context matters.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to give you that. And so chapter, page 200, you know, belonging in parenthood will help you a lot for those who might be wondering. All right. Now, real quick, how do you manage those feelings of guilt or shame when those school-related incidents occur, especially when you're already navigating life as an immigrant parent?
I'm telling you, it was tough. I'm not, you know, I'm not here to kind of sugarcoat anything, as it were. It was tough because, I mean, it was so tough that it even impacted my husband and I, because I said, you are not even acting like somebody that they are sending these messages to. You know what I mean? And, you know, I guess for him, it's like, I said, no, like when they send these things, it hits me at the core, because it's like a judgment on the child. Mm. And, you know, I mean, I know everyone says that their child is wonderful. I do. But at the same time, I know my children's, you know, shortcomings. Let me put it that way. I do. I know. In fact, sometimes people are like, you're too hard on them in terms of that shortcoming. But I do. And that's not to say, because I'm not trying to say they're perfect or anything, like you said, children.
Yeah. But they are your kids. So,
whenever those people come, I would say, you don't know this child. That's kind of always, you know, what used to just reverberate for me. And it became, I mean, why I said it was so painful was it became personal, because I feel like this is the way that I've been judged, right? A lot all my life.
Mm.
And it's just from not knowing me. Like if you knew me, people who know me have such a different experience of me, different, you know, like they will go to bat. You know what I mean? Like,
for you,
loyalist, you know,
yes.
But that's because they know me. But if you just see me from outside or one or two interactions and you make, you know, your summary judgments on that, you are missing out, right, on just this kaleidoscope of who the person is. And so for me, it was like, you don't know this child. And all of this is impacting him, where he's not like even wanting to go to school and just hating school and not wanting to be there at all. And so it was this back and forth of them saying, well, you know, he's anxious and maybe he's coming from home. And I said, have you ever thought that he could be coming from this school as well? Because this child is not the same child at home as what people are describing in the school. So having to navigate that tension all the time, I'm telling you, once you see emails from the school, your heart will start beating, because it's like...
Exactly. What has happened again?
What is the thing they're about to tell me now, right? What is the thing they're about to tell me now? Because it cannot, you know, avail from history. It's not going to be positive, right? Or as positive as I would like.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you have the custodians and all the other people who interact with telling you how kind and polite
your child is. Yeah.
You know,
Kind of, you know,
they'll be more patient. But again, remember, I always say I have to hold on to the hard truth or to the empathy side of it, to say these people are dealing with a lot of kids in the classroom, right? And not enough resources. So I have to always put that at the back of my mind. I always say too that, you know, being a teacher, these are all the things that are involved, right? So
otherwise quit that job and do something else.
That's my thing, right? Yep. Like, stop perpetuating this bias. If you know you cannot be a teacher, then, you know, don't be one, as opposed to being here and having children having this negative experiences as they cycle through your classroom. In that sense, obviously I can't speak to other people, but it's like, you can imagine that in this school too, there are not many children who look like them, and so it becomes even like a double, you know, what do you call it, double whammy, right, in that sense, for you to see what is going on here, you know. So
and for there's so many things to just unpack from there. Please, moms and dads or guardians listening to this, don't take it out on the child. Like, again, seek to understand.
Yeah,
but you have to also, even if you're there's a learning curve your child has to overcome. Remember, it's their first time; they're still little.
Yes,
so it's never to blame the child for any of this.
See, what I want to add here is this thing you just said, especially for people who are coming from Nigeria, where you know the teachers had your children's best interests at heart. So they report your children when your children are not doing well, you know, that kind of thing. Take things, hold things loosely, you know, because there's that tendency for when they say, oh, he did this, he did that, you go and start, you know, like you said, taking it out on the child without really kind of hearing what happened with them. Because children will tell you, right? They will kind of give you feedback about what's going on in the school here and there. And you just have to keep your ears out to listen and not just take hook, line and sinker what the school system is telling you. And that's what makes it so interesting, because, you know, this is a system that we should trust, right? Yeah. If I put my child in this place for 6-8 hours, I should trust them that they have, you know, my child's interest, what's best for the child. And so there's that weight that we may unnecessarily put on this, not knowing, right, that sometimes there's just not that care. I'll put it as care, right? Mm. That, you know, care for persons, even dignity. There's just not that. And you can tell from the language, right? I remember, again, this younger one, he's been in the Gifted and Talented program.
Nice.
It was so interesting to me that it was just this past year, back and forth with this woman, we've been going back and forth. I had to go and pull up, you know, Section 5 OB of rehabilitation. I had to pull out Gifted and Talented, the acts, right, in the New Jersey state laws and all that. So I'm going back and forth with them and the principal. And then, you know, but every time she'll say, but this, I want him to take responsibility. But her emails are always full of buts, you know, but this. Yes, but, yes, but. I'm like, okay, no problem. So then I don't remember what she said. And she kind of said, oh, well, you know, they're done with Gifted and Talented in elementary. And I said, hold on. Are they not going to go to middle school, you know, and continue the program? She said, no, the middle school doesn't have it. I said, you should have told me this 3 years ago. I'd have pulled the child out. She was shocked. I said, because I don't think it's been worth it in terms of the emotional weight of being in this
place.
Like always on his, you know, case and saying he didn't do this and this and this. And, you know, she said, I'm only trying to help him because if he goes to middle school, he's not going to have all this guidance and all. I said, thank you. You know, however, if I had known this was not a continuity thing, I would have saved him that emotional turmoil.
Gotcha. Because,
you know, I said, guess what? I don't need you to tell me and him that he's gifted, right?
We know that already.
So that was it. I mean, she was quite shocked. She was like, really? I said, yeah, I would have pulled him out. And it wasn't, I said, it wouldn't have been, you know, me displeased or anything. It would have just been like, okay, this is not working, right? Let's quickly just end it and find other activities that, bring the child more joy, right?
Just want to thank you for sharing that. As you were saying, I remember something, and your book also, share this experience. So we had an opportunity to pull Ari out of school for 2 months, actually more than 2 months, almost 3 months. It was
3 months, yeah.
3 months, yeah. While we went to Nigeria to bring our baby back home, you know, baby. And I didn't know how, I knew I was traumatized by the system here, but I didn't know how really traumatized I was until after I dropped her in a, well, we enrolled her in a private school back in Nigeria. And I'd forgotten so much about, because I've never been a parent in Nigeria. I'd always gone to school, so I didn't know what it was like to be on the other side.
Yeah.
And the first time I got a call from the school, I was like, hey, God, what has happened again? But they were just calling to just verify that she didn't have any food at it, because we paid for, like, lunch. And every time I would go, I'll be trying to, you know, okay, how's she doing? Tell me. And they'll look at me like, Mom, calm down. I'm like, is she not super active? She's not even the most active child we have in class. Is she not just... They were looking at me like, why am I saying this is about my child? And in talking to you about it, you're like, yep, I knew that was coming, but I was going to let you experience that. So the environment matters.
It does.
And one thing I just took out from there is that I wish we could have the way we parent back home and our teachers, how they just take the child, like, this is our child, we'll fix it. We won't call parents for every little thing.
I mean, see, again, I always say, you know, we're talking about context, and you have to kind of, you know, within context of the environment, allow for the, you know, allow for things. Because I know right? Schools have probably got into trouble for not calling enough.
Yeah.
So there's that part, right? Like, you have a lot of people who are ready to go to litigation, ready to do a lot of, you know, things that you would kind of wonder. So yeah. I get that. I completely get it, you know, in that sense. But I think, like we're saying,
it's done too much.
To me, this becomes either the paradox or the conundrum, whichever we're going to look at it.
It's something quite all right.
We're living in these towns, paying all this money. You're promising us that our children will be, you know, educated. But it's literally, it feels like the children come, but you cannot wait to get rid of them. Like, it's like,
they don't belong.
You're doing this, yes, because we are being almost like forced to. I don't know how to explain. You know, my job is the, I don't know how to explain it. Like, my job is the teaching, not the child.
Not the child, but, yeah. And the kids, they can see, they can sense it, by the way.
Of course.
They know.
You know? And so it's like, well, but the teaching, you're teaching the child, though. You're teaching that child. So there needs to be a little bit more, I would say, you know, holistic presentation, right, in that sense. But I get it. Like, you know, you don't want to be too close to a child and then have the parent report you, you know, things like that. So
people
are always trying to walk, you know, within the boundaries. I mean, you know, both of us are educators now, so you kind of know college there are certain things you can, you know, so we are aware of that. But again, within the dictates, right, of what is right, what is legal, what is moral, you can still see a child, right? You can still see them, still hear them, still care for them. I remember listening to a podcast with a woman who was Teacher of the Year. It was a lady from Tennessee.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, listening to her, I could just feel the care in her voice. I could just feel the way she was, like, you know, helping them almost like, you know, this...
discover themselves, yeah.
Yes, the Colby's learning levels, right? Helping them just push through, right? Those basic things that even you do for your children, you know, and I... What does she want, Teacher of the Year? It's not hard, right, to kind of see that perspective. But then people kind of saying, if you're too soft, the person, you know, if you do those things, then it looks like you're soft. People take you for granted, this, that, that. And I said, no, you can actually balance both. Right? You can be firm and kind.
They're not
mutually exclusive. And kindness is... Kindness is felt.
It's just a basic thing, especially at that age and for first experience with school, and even for the parents who are still trying to navigate all of this.
Yeah,
kindness is non-negotiable.
Kind, you know. But sometimes you find your child going through the whole system, and you don't know nothing about the teacher. Like, this teacher knows it's just
nothing about your child. Yeah,
this class, and that's it. There was no interaction, right? In that sense,
no exchange.
And I'm thinking, what? I still remember my primary school teachers. I do,
because they left an indelible mark on you.
Mark. Primary, secondary, you know. Pockets of them, not everyone.
The ones that really stood out.
Remember them, because it was that, like, principle of care, right? And this is what's her name, Bell Hooks, right? For people who teaching with transgression, or what's that book? She talks about care in the classroom, that is the thing that was completely lost with desegregation, with all of those things, because she said when those, you know, when black babies were in the classroom with the black teachers, there was care. Like, they taught them manners, taught them things, taught, like, your teacher knew your mother. If you did anything terrible, they would, you know, like, you know. So she just keeps saying that was what was lost, and if you could find that back, right?
So
classrooms become a place where children feel like, you know, they belong, just as they should at home, right? At so home, they should not be
that discrepancy.
Huge discrepancy, like a chasm sometimes.
So I have two questions. So you mentioned a little bit about just, you know, neurodivergence. And I know this short time is not even going to do it justice. But real quick, especially for parents who might, you know, in your chapter in ADHD is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You reframe neurodivergence in a powerful way.
Yeah.
And while also still balancing that, it's not, you know, like, it's a lot.
Yeah.
Now, how did you come to embrace these lenses, both for yourself and your child?
Yeah. Again, I think it's from seeing the child in action, right? Because they can tell you everything about ADHD or whatever, But then when you see them, the way they think, the way they reason, and it's the two sons, it's not just one. You're like, what? How are they able to take in all of this complex learning just like that, right? In that sense. But then this same person cannot put their shoes away, right? It's kind of like, or, you know, I can't tell you how many glasses we've lost. How many, what else, jackets, right? Those kinds of things. It's almost like you're buying it and you're buying double because you know it's gonna get missing. But again, I just think this also has to do with development. The older a child gets, the better they get at some things over time. But the executive function part is still a thing that people still have to kind of, you know, wrestle with. So it was from observing, just observing and saying, wow, there's a lot of creativity. That's the word I'll use. There's a lot of creativity here that if one were to look beyond, they're not doing X, doing Y, doing Z as they're supposed to, you can appreciate the divergent thinking. Because that's why, I guess that's why it's called neurodivergence. You can appreciate the divergent thinking, the way they express themselves and all of that. Very honest, very refreshingly honest, I have to say. You know, so from there, and then I started to think to myself, I'm like, okay, I mean, genetics though, and I know this stuff is genetics, and I'm seeing even some, you know, seeing almost like me in certain things replicated in these children. I'm like, okay, is there something I should be looking for?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then obviously I started doing all the research, and then, you know, it was like the blocks that had fallen into place. And so for me, I just felt, okay, the one thing that I will not, at least I'll work on to make them feel, is that, you know, self-censoring and self-judgment, because you kind of find yourself not putting yourself out there sometimes because of that fear of, you know, what they call rejection sensitivity. So it's like, okay, now that I know all of this, I'm going to help guide them, right? Just to say, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah.
Now, I know some people take umbrage at that because it's like, well, you know, but how are they going to fit in with the neurotypicals? And I say, well, but do they have... Right?
Exactly. But these are not new issues, by the way. We've we just didn't know what it was called before.
Exactly. We understand. Because if you then look, all the people who have given us a lot of the, you know, creativity and the things we see in this world, if you go and check, they were probably neurodivergent, right? In some way. Talk about Leonardo da Vinci, all
Albert
this.
Einstein. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, why the insistence on fitting in, though? You know, why that insistence? How do you help them find their own way, but recognize that the world will try to make them fit in and lock them into a box, and that could feel isolating, right? So it's you're not denying the, what would I call it, the downsides of this thing, but more like you want to raise the positive sides more so that the downsides gets, you know, the noise gets dampened from there.
I need to go read that chapter. Okay. Lastly, from my end, before I have you do your summary tips of the day, if you had to write a letter to your younger self, so let's time travel a little bit.
Yep.
One letter to the girl with a suitcase full of dreams.
Okay.
Another to the grandchild born of two worlds. What would those words hold?
Oh my goodness. It would just be that you're enough, right? I feel like that sounds like a cliche, but it's not, it's something that a lot of children need to hear, right? And enough doesn't mean you don't get to work towards, you know, excellence and things like that. But you see, this constant hypercriticism, I feel like that's the one thing that I will take myself away. If we were to talk to my younger self to say, you know, you're enough, right? You didn't need to X, you didn't, why you didn't need to do, you know, all of these wonderful things just to be, you know, just to belong, right? So that would be one thing. And then if I were to speak back to my younger self coming into the US, it would have been not to have been so fearful, because you know, you're making this, like we said, straddling two spaces, how do I not fit in, and then graduate school being its own, you know, crucible in that sense. So if I were to go back, it's like, just be more, what's the word, like open your eyes more, right? Be more outward facing as opposed to inward facing. Mm-hmm. Even though I do think that the tools we have now have really helped, right?
Yes, helped people like me,
because people say, oh, you're so good on camera. I said, because I'm not talking to anybody, right? I'm talking to, you know, a kind of myself, right, in that sense. So there's no censoring there. But if there are other people in the room, obviously it's like, oh, you know, so you get to be more of yourself on camera. So I think that some of those things have helped, some of the tools we have now have helped the expressive, creative side of us. And so that's why I feel like children now actually at an advantage, right? They can build their confidence very quickly, do all the kinds of things that took us years to master, right? In that sense. And so, you know, you just have to be able to ride the wave of technology, recognizing its downsides, but recognizing that this is a thing that can help a lot of children, right, who feel like they don't belong, also try to find their voice in a way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for just so many things you've left us with today. For quickly, for those who want to find you and find your book, where can they...
Okay.
Get a hold of you.
So the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Ingram, right? Everywhere, basically, books are sold. It's also on my website if you want to buy directly from my website, otutuewuchiku.com. And, you know, all LinkedIn, if you follow me on LinkedIn, you see the link right there to say Get the Belonging Paradox. So this is a work that, you know, you were there more how long this thing took, almost 2 years of just... Yeah. Sitting with this stuff and it being so personal in some areas, and in other areas it's like, what is the thing I want to tell people, right? What is the thing that I want people to see without a shadow of a doubt? And that is that thing of that belonging is yours, right? Whatever life space you find yourself, belonging is yours. You, because we're human, because we're here, we already belong. And so we just have to find that truth and then, you know, beam it out to other people.
I will put tag all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
For reminding us of so many things. Yeah. Advocacy is fierce, but it can also be a form of love.
Mm-hmm.
That parenting across cultures can seem like a protest, but it's also an art. And,
an art.
And as we're still finding spaces we belong, we should start with exploring that within ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So for anyone listening, if you're navigating the U.S. education system as an immigrant parent, we hope that this conversation is like a balm. Perhaps you don't even know you need it yet. Perhaps come August, you have to come back and listen to this episode again, because it's going to make sense.
And the one thing I want to add from a parental point of view, very critical, that as a parent, you have to find your own belonging, right? That parental belonging, because it seeps out to the children. So just knowing who you are, right? That this is me. I came to this country, like I said, I didn't come, you know, hopefully undocumented. But even if you came that way and you're not legal, that's fine, right? That I belong here. And so as a result of that, my children too, you know, belong here, right? They should get all the rights and whatever due to a person who belongs, you know, in this culture, in this country and all that. So we knowing helps us teach our children, and they
exactly
can continue to pass on, you know, that belonging wherever they are.
Thank you. And if you're also simply trying to raise your kids who to make them feel seen, safe and strong, we hope this episode is a reminder that you're not alone. Let us know what resonated with you, share with the parents who needs it, and remember the work we do in choir corners, in school hallways, in front of our emails as we're responding to that school or the teacher, or even at the kitchen tables, it matters. Until next time, I'm Mo, and this is the Most of a Podcast, where we hold space for all the in between. Thank you so much, Otito.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Yes. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.